we're going to cover greed. Greed is one of those things that, for those of us who don't have it, it's sort of a weird emotion that I think a lot of us actually struggle with understanding when you don't have it. It's sort of like if you're not a big drinker and you see people that can't complete a day without a drink, you sort of don't understand it. Where the need comes from, where the disease comes from to desire things and desire something on an addiction level, right? I think we can all probably agree that greed is a disease. But I've been studying this for a very, very long time. And mainly because I'm trying to figure out what motivates man and what motivates the sort of those who feel like they really want to run the world. You know, at first when someone tells you, well, there's this cabal of families that run the world, and you sort of resist that because you're like, who would want that job? I mean, yeah, it sounds like you'd have a lot of power to do a lot of things, but come on, eventually, your little power simulator, being able to do whatever you want to whomever you want for as long as you want, it gets old. It gets old, and it gets old very quickly, you know? And the only thing that would fuel that day-to-day being interesting would be pure and utter ignorance or the disease of greed. Why do I say ignorance? Well, I think ignorance would feed the idea that as you do get the same thing over and over and over and over again, it never gets old. And I think you need a modicum of ignorance to ever make that true. Remember, ignorance and stupidity, two different things. Stupidity is when you should know better, and ignorance is you don't know better. It's just who you are. We're all ignorant in plenty of areas. But with greed, it's weird. I think for me, greed stems from something very simple, and I've said it several times. I've said it several times in several shows that I think that greed is fueled by a lack of internal definition. You need something external to you in order to have what you think you need. And I think it all stems from the primitive archetype in man, which is we used to all be cavemen and cave ladies, and we had to hoard things in order to survive. And I think that, you know, on the note of hoarding in this world, you'll notice that people who hoard have experienced in many, many cases a moment of trauma just prior to turning into hoarders. And I think that what psychologists and psychiatrists have completely missed in any televised analysis of a hoarder is that all they're doing is their archetypes of living today, the more sophisticated types of relaxing and realizing that there's an infinite supply of things, it turns into that primal man, primal woman thing where they're struggling to get the basics and they go back to hoarding because hoarding had to have been the way that the caveman survived. I've got a whole pile of grain over there, a pile of beef jerky, meat I've cut off animals, a pile of furs, you know. And so trauma tends to precede this regression in the mind. And hoarding is nothing more than a almost emotionless view into the mind of a greedy person. It is the sort of the emotionless strategic resources version of greed. And I definitely wanted to make a distinction there about greed being slightly different than getting the basics to life. Now, there's something called strategic resources, sort of a military designation of resources in the world. And it has to do with the resources that you need in order to survive. If you don't have them, you start to lose bodies, warm bodies. They start turning cold. When people tell us that North Korea is a threat to the world, all right, they get 65% of their strategic resources to stay alive within the confines of their borders from China and foreign countries around that surround them. They don't have 65% of the basics to exist in that country because it's mostly mountainous terrains that can't grow food. And of course, their regime tends to stifle their growth, right? Kim Jong-il, or Ung, he seems to be eating pretty well. But greed is an externalization of what you think you need in life. Because greed is really, the definition of greed, I think, has a definitive moment that's scientifically definable. And let me tell you. Let's say that I need 10 of something. Okay. And let's just say we analyze how hard it is to get those 10 things. And we determine that we actually, it's always going to be easy to get these things, whatever it is, peanuts. And we get our 10. Now, I determined 10 based on sort of a regimen of, you know, maybe I'm going to go 5 days and I want to have 2 a day. And so, you know, this is Monday and I'm going to get it all for Monday through Friday. So I'm getting 10. So when I say you need 10, I don't mean that's at the precipice of the next breath. I mean, you know, you figure out what you need. It's when you take the 11th one, when you don't need the 11th one, that you start to get very close to the switch to greed. Obviously, I don't mean you accidentally took an extra one, or one was left over and you took it. I mean, other people were needing 10, and they hadn't grabbed their 10 yet, and you grabbed an 11th one. And this is when you're not in a state of fear. This is when the world is balanced, and you simply don't need it, but you want it. You know that there's people that are greedy that like to see piles of things, but they have more than you, or more than most people, and they just like to know they've got a bunch of it. And the weird thing is, they actually need more, or feel like they need more, after they already have this gigantic pile of whatever the hell it is. Now, I'm going to start off with material possessions first, because I think that's the easiest way for all of us to get on the same page. But we are going to talk about power eventually, which is the emotional greed, which is more driven by fear. Possession greed is really the acidic greed that is driven out of a lack of identity. Material possessions, which is interesting, if you have a balanced life, if when you look in the mirror you love who you see, I mean you love who you see, for real, then that's your first stabilizing mechanism to staying out of greed. If you like the way your day transgresses, right? How does your day go from start to finish? If you feel like you're a productive person in society, then that'll also stabilize you. And I think what you'll find in the world is that there's two types of things that we typically, from the possession standpoint of greed, want to achieve. You have people that create piles of things to impress you. They want to bring you to their house, and they want to show you their pile of stuff, and they want you to react to it. And then there's people who create piles of stuff simply to tell you that they have more than you. Now think about that. Both those moments are really for the person who's creating the pile themselves. Come into my house and look at my pile and awe over it. Shock and awe over my pile of stuff. Could be an 80-inch television, 100-inch television. Look at it and give me the reaction I want you to have, that I done good, that I done got big TV, and tell me that, right? And that's them, you know, eating off of the emotion off that person that walked in the room. Then you have your more asshole-y kind of pile maker, which is, look at what I have that you don't have. And that is strictly out of a fear. It's going to be different than our other power fear. But they're fearful that they have not become something substantive. And so they go for the most low-hanging sort of mouth-breathing algorithm, which is, I'm going to get more stuff than you. In fact, it could be a pile of shit you don't even care about. But they're going to say, I got more of this shit than you do. And so it is sort of awe-striking when you see someone have maybe 1,000,000 pencils in their garage. You're like, what? That's a lot of pencils, dude. You say, yeah, see, I've got lots of pencils. But the person who wants to throw it in your face. And so they use greed as a mechanism, as a band-aid onto their own emotional stability, as a band-aid onto their own self-image, which is obviously horribly flawed. So this is where we... we need to start studying greed a little bit deeper. If you're parents of children, then one, obviously you want to check yourself first. I think most people don't suffer from greed that much, honestly. But we want to make sure that as children hoard things, which is a natural animalistic instinct of survival, that we sort of, as we have to teach them to share, maybe as they exhibit one or more of these things I'm mentioning, you at least have a nice kind of clever, wise way of talking to them about it such that they don't feel like they're being confronted in some horrible way, right? I find that my friends who are extremely wealthy, if I can call them my friend, because we've had a conversation and we're on the same page of life and society, they either have possessions that are very, very valuable, but they could care less about them, or they have almost normal possessions. They'll have a few really heavy-duty possessions and then some normal stuff inside. Like, I'll give you an example. One of my friends owns a gorgeous house. I mean, this is a multi-million-dollar home, which even in California, you'd be like, damn, it's a nice house. But inside, he has slowly acquired over the course of his lifetime some beautiful items. But there's almost like a span of every decade that he's been alive. He has the finest things from those decades. And it's interesting to see it all mixed together. But you'll walk into the kitchen. I believe they just changed this, but there was a tube television in his kitchen clear up until this decade. A CRT television, you know, like the old kind. Flat screens have been a standard for at least 10 years. And he doesn't care, you know. He is a man that always warns people that, you know, if you get into this idea that if you have money and you buy technical things, that supposedly you immediately know how to use them, you know, I could buy the most expensive electric guitar as if that's going to help you play the guitar. Hell, man, get a $110 acoustic guitar, master that thing, then go get your Les Paul, you know. But my friends with more money don't show it at all. I've got friends of mine, I don't even know how much money they have, but I know it's a lot, okay? But you go to their house and you sit down, and it's a nice home, but it says you could get the house too, you know? You'd need a little bit of success, but not a tremendous amount of success, and you could have the same home. And, you know, you'd need more decades to fill up every nook and cranny like these folks have because they're a little bit older, but in the end, what they do, and the reason why I mention that, is that they actually have figured out a way to value themselves by what they do in life, what they create in life, and not what they have as possessions. But what happens when we look out into the world? I'm going to go from the materialistic standpoint, because that's usually the only thing that we, as peasants, meaning, you know, we're not the ones running the world, we're not the ones wanting to run the world. Some of us would like to contribute ideas. I think all of us on this show want to contribute ideas, but you know what I'm saying. On the materialistic side of things, we have the situation where if we glance out of our world for any split second of time and we happen to look at the world, depending on where you live, right, you see symbolism of commercialism everywhere. And that symbolism and commercialism is telling you that it's almost yearning you like a piper that you need these possessions in order to be accepted in life. I think too, what's interesting is I see this one a lot in Southern California. You know, it depends on if you're single or if you're married, or, you know, like you're in the dating game, you're not in the dating game. But when you're in the dating game in Southern California, and let's say you were trying to remain non-materialistic, which is what you should be if that's what you're into, right? You obviously want to find someone who's not materialistic. To compromise that one thing will drive you crazy. You'll be in hell. And I've been very, very lucky. The people I've dated have not been materialistic. Some of them own amazing possessions, but it's not their drive in life, right? They don't wake up crying because they don't have a new one today or tomorrow, you know? But anyway, you will see people, you're like, I'm a dude, so I like women. So I'll see a guy with a beautiful woman at times in my life. You'll see them with someone who's very attractive. And someone you're like, oh my gosh, you know, she's beautiful, she's hot, whatever. And, you know, of course, you need to make sure the person has a brain. But before you get to that brain thought, when your instincts are just firing for the opposite sex or whatever the hell you're attracted to, right? And you see someone fawning over someone, and you see them with possessions, and you're like, that dude's getting that girl because of that car. Something like that. you're making that assumption, of course. And you start to get this subliminal pull towards, well, maybe I do need a few more possessions. Maybe I do need a little bit more stuff. Maybe I shouldn't be saving my money for my future or whatever for investment opportunities. Maybe I should liquidate a little bit of that security and put it in some fun stuff. The marketing machine is powerful in this world. And because the internet is packed with advertising, you still get it from there as well. Think about how much greed a farmer in the Midwest of the 1800s had pulling at his soul strings, right? Zero. That dude was worried about waking up, making sure his livestock didn't wander away in the middle of the night, making sure all the animals didn't eat up his crops. Hopefully his family's healthy that morning. And everyone's got to run out and just do a day of iteration to exist. That's all that dude did, was get his family over the hump of that era in society to hopefully live a better day in the future. Greed, well, there wasn't room and time for greed. But today we now live in the lap of luxury. We don't have to hunt for our food anymore. You know, every piece of knowledge we'd ever want comes in all different flavors on the internet. The truth, the lies, and the manipulation, right? So we're in an era where we have to be extremely careful about greed, filling up our souls, filling up our children's souls. So just to recap the possession side of things, I think that the possession side of greed is an externalization of a lack of purpose. You can't find a purpose within yourself, and so you turn on this mechanism, well, I want to be impressive in a crowd. And I can either be impressive in a crowd because I just picked up my Oscar or my Emmy or my Grammy off the stage. And I'm not saying that those institutions are the best measurements of your skills. You know, something of an accolade that you actually did accomplish something on a very interesting level. And you walk down into the audience and now you can just exude this amazingness. In fact, it's more amazing if you're driving some old Datsun 3210. You know, I mean, it's like you could just, you're just an amazing person, and it doesn't matter what you have on or what you, where you live, you're just an amazing person, right? If you can't do that, then you go get a bunch of stuff. And they're like, well, the guy seems like a moron, but you know what we got in his limousine, and when he took me to the top of that hill in Hollywood, and his houses were $10 million and we're up there messing around. Who is this guy? What does he do for a living? You know, and I will say in California, the most amazing, I'll tell you, a lot of the big homes that you'll see and everywhere, right? There's multi-million dollar homes everywhere. Every once in a while, you'll meet someone who's extremely impressive, and they're everywhere, but I just don't have a chance to meet them all. But every once in a while, I'll go to a big home and I'll meet someone. It's like, this person's distinguished. They're amazing. They really went from bottom to top. They earned every penny. But the amount of people who have fallen uphill in Los Angeles area is crazy. You'll get to the top of the hill and you'll start talking to the guy who owns the place, and the amount of indoctrination that the guy believes is incredible. And you start to wonder, how the hell did you make all this money with such a retarded mind? You know, I don't mean the mentally handicapped condition. I just mean a slower brain. How did you get this far? And it starts to speak to the idea that if you follow all the rules, sometimes you can get rewarded heavily for it. But then again, you're at the top of the hill, the dumbest guy on the planet. So what's the point of that? You know? So the goal would be to get both, maybe. I have a friend of mine who is selling her house. And the house was let's just give you an idea for those of you who think that having big homes or something would be a great idea. She is selling her house. It's a 36,000 square foot house. It has a 24 car garage in the basement. It is selling for roughly about $20 million, this home. It's down here in Orange County. And I asked her, I said, do you miss it? Because she's got another home that she's living in now, and she's selling this other big house. And I said, do you miss that big house? And the one she's in now is very modest. Very beautiful, but very modest. And I asked her, I said, do you miss it? And she goes, nope. I said, well, tell me what it's like to, one, live in a house like that, and then why don't you miss it? And she said, well, you know what? She goes, we had at least 6 staff members at all times taking care of this house because it was so massive you could get lost in it. You could literally be in it all week and you wouldn't see your spouse the whole time. She said, I was never alone in my own home. She goes, you know, when you take a shower at your place, you can walk out naked, right? You can go get your clothes on, walking around the hallways, right? I'm like, yeah. She goes, I couldn't do that. She goes, once a month, I would have a day where I told all the servants, clean this house up so that I can survive 48 hours without your assistance and then leave because I want this night to myself. And she said she'd just walk around in a robe. Now, obviously, we've seen that kind of thing in the Downton Abbey sort of era on television, and that's why your butlers and your maids knew everything about you. It's because in order to have that freedom, you'd have to expose all of your life to these individuals. And I don't know if any of us would be prepared to do that in this day and age, right? But I know people, and she's one of them, that have had sort of infinite money. you know, waking up in the morning and deciding to eat, you know, lunch in Paris the next day and hopping on a private jet and going straight to Paris and eating lunch in Paris and then coming home. You know, they'd stay. But the idea is infinite cash. And there definitely were moments where that was, it was every time that something was brand new, it was fun and interesting. But the minute it became a repeated cycle, it started to lose half of its allure. So flying to Paris and eating there the next day, and of course there's part of it's just telling your friends that you did it. The second time you do it, it's like, eh, we did this before, you know? So you have to have something more to spending money than just exhibition. And I've just got friends that have been everywhere and done everything with everyone who is anyone in the planet Earth, right? And some of them really loved it, and some of them thought it was a pain in the ass, you know? Amazing stories. I've got friends that Michael Jackson called them up and said, I want you to come to me right now. We're going to have a conversation. We're going to have a meeting about something I'm thinking of, something I'm designing. And they said, are you okay with that? And they were like, sure. He goes, okay, well, the car is coming to your house right now. Nothing, and then a car coming to their house. And they're here in Los Angeles, and Michael Jackson's on a cruise ship off the coast of Miami that you can only get to through a helicopter. They pack up their shit real quick, get in this limousine, go to the LAX, fly directly to Miami, get on a helicopter, and they're flown directly across the Atlantic Ocean to this boat to have a meeting for a few hours. I got friends like that. And you know, that's kind of fun for the first time, but then a couple other times where people had done the exact same thing with them, it started being a pain in the ass. It's like, oh my God, none of one of these dudes, right? This is, you know, it takes a toll on your body, takes a toll on your soul. But most of us peasants at the bottom, we're like, damn, man, that'd be cool. And it's not stupid to think it's cool. I'm just saying we're more prone to think that that would be a way of life as opposed to a one-off moment in our life. So let's talk about greed of power, because if you watch this show, that's really probably the one that keeps you up at night more than anything else. I wanted to start out with the material possession one, because I think that's the one what you and I all deal with at the bottom, where we don't have infinite cash, right? Imagine someone wanting power over someone else. Now, we know there's all kinds of gradients of this, right? A rapist is a person who wants power over someone else. I remember when I was a little kid and someone told me that what rape was. It must have been around 9 or 10 because I was in the presence of my mom. I lived with my dad mostly after 11. And I asked my mom, I said, you know, why do people do that? And she said, well, it's they're getting excited about having the power over the person. And, you know, I won't lie. I didn't understand it at all. 9 and 10, I was like, I don't get it. I don't get, you know, wouldn't you want someone to love you? You know, I think in the interest of power, it really boils down to one sentence. People who are greedy for power simply want one statement to be true. And I don't know if there's a second statement. I really don't. And it goes like this. I don't want anyone to tell me what to do. That's what power is. You know? As it occurs to me, I shall engage in it. And beyond that, there is nothing else. We talked about material possessions. And the subtext of that first introductory section is the following. It's your perspective of possessions that makes you greedy in a particular area, right? It is what you deem to be of great value based on your upbringing that you will hoard. There's guys who hoard newspapers because to them that was information, and they feared something important happening in the world, and they're going to miss it, which is why they hoarded newspapers. Other guys hoard Star Wars shit because it was the last era of their life that was fun. Maybe they were still living with their parents in high school or something, and Star Wars comes out in 1977, and it's the greatest thing on planet Earth. And then life started, and it was tough, and it was hard, and it wasn't a fantasy. And so they start hoarding it and started surrounding themselves with it, right? You've seen this a million times on the internet. There's a Teenage Ninja Turtle guy out there. There's some crazy guy living in his house. You know, and again, if you can do it harmlessly, man, I'm not here to tell him he shouldn't do it. Enjoy yourself. If you can totally create a survivable world where you're not hurting anyone else, you know, your definition of success is your definition of success. I mean, I'll take it up to the next chapter, which is power. It's one thing to say, you can't tell me what to do, which I think is the rudimentary thought of someone who's greedy in the terms of power. But the second tier to that is to say, who are you afraid of telling you what to do? That you would make such a preservation for the power to make sure that no one can tell you what to do. The elite of this world absolutely, positively survive on the thought that no one can tell them what to do. Remember the old story that Aaron Rousseau, the director and creator of the movie Freedom to Fascism, he said that Nick Rockefeller told him that eventually the world will be microchipped. And then if he comes on board and becomes a politician and gets within this elite circle, that when the microchips arrived, he's going to have a KMA chip, kiss my ass chip, which means anytime he's at a surveillance checkpoint in this Gestapo world, remember, just like I said in the war episode, what their plans for the bottom of the pyramid is not a utopian world. It is a THX-1138 world. And I think very specifically that kind of world under an Agenda 21 reduced population framework. That movie had very few people in it in terms of the overall society, and they were just cogs in a wheel, man. If you haven't seen that film, you've done yourself an injustice. Go see it. It's George Lucas's student film, which actually then was, I believe, remade as a feature film. So I think there's somewhere there's a copy of one that is not so elaborate. Doesn't have Duvall in it. But the first tier of the elite, the Illuminati, as they call themselves, right? You know, there's this funny thing that if you know about the Illuminati and you call them Illuminati, you're a crazy conspiracy freak. But if you look at the book, I believe it was released in 1646. I think that was the date or the year. That's called Illuminati, the Enlightened Ones. They're the ones that gave themselves that name, not us. And it's funny that they've demonized what they've called themselves. So you're unable to use the word that they use for themselves. It's interesting. You know, the other world were elite, and then we like to call them the ruling class, right? But their first tier of requirement is securing a universe where no one can tell them what to do. And then their hope at their level is that they what they want to do is exactly congruent with their neighbor at the ruling class level. That way, no one is worried about their neighbor telling them what to do within the construct of their little group at the top. I assure you, they do not agree at the top. I assure you, they disagree at the top. I assure you that the constant sell of what to do is held in meetings way above the Bilderberg meetings, right? The Bilderberg meetings are more like, we're about to tell you what's going to happen. And we're going to give you the illusion that you have an opinion that matters. If anything, we're just trying to harvest better refinements of our own agendas, but we're not allowing you to participate. Those Bilderberg meetings are not debates. They're passing out the minutes of what is going to occur in the next 12 months, right? And maybe every once in a while, maybe they have a bump of a 5-year, 10-year agenda, but I don't think they want to tell anyone and telegraph their poker hand until it's time to roll. And I think most people that attend get an adrenaline rush that they're, one, invited to these meetings, and two, they're usually fairly financially secure people who just want to watch the world burn because they believe they're non-flammable, you know, they're non-expendable. And for the most part, maybe they are. Who knows? So the first thought to review is at the elite power structure level is no one's going to tell me what to do. The next tier is once you've secured that, you can put an intellectual layer on top of it, which is to say, all right, we've now secured the fact that whatever we think can be done and no one's going to tell us what to do. If anybody tries, we'll just have them wiped out. You know, whether they're a country or a person, they'll just be erased. So again, we've got it all figured out. We have secured that no one's going to tell us what to do. Now, what intellectual purpose can we put on top of greed? Well, let's run the world. Why not? Someone's got to do it. I definitely don't like the way Joe the Plumber runs the world. He thinks that everyone should have inalienable rights. He thinks that everyone should own a gun in their house. Just in case we want to come and take that guy out, he thinks he should be able to fire bullets at us. How dare he think he's over me? Doesn't he know that my intellectual capacity and my breeding of my genes, my elite genes, my Illuminati genes, doesn't he know that I am absolutely in every measurable way over him, superior to him? I bet he thinks he knows world history. Ha ha ha, he doesn't know. We have hoarded history and put it in our little vault libraries. Isn't it funny how he thinks that JFK was killed by Lee Harvey Oswald, that Abraham Lincoln was trying to free the slaves? What a petty mind he has. Osama bin Laden ran 9/11. McVeigh took out the Oklahoma City bombing event. They're laughing their asses off because they understand how utterly distant we are from them. Okay? So once we allow a layer of humanity to engage in a greed that is at the level where no one can tell them what to do, we have created a subspecies to rule us. A czar layer over us. And you might think, well, I don't do that. And I'm not saying you do. But look to your neighbors. There are commemorative plates released in the UK to honor the Windsor family, the royal family of England, who has no British blood in their family, save maybe Princess Di's kids, right? I mean, honestly, what is British blood anyway? But we have this monarch worship. And then we have people, not too many people in this show, or who watch this show, but we have people that tell us that, oh, those are just ceremonial families. They don't have any money. They don't have any power. I got a friend of mine who tells me that all the time. The king and queen, or the queen of England, doesn't have any power. You know, she gets roughly 44 million pounds a year to keep Windsor Castle sort of without too much dust, right? But if you look through the books in the parliament, the laws that rule that country, you could have Prince Charles molest a boy on camera during a press conference. And without a lynching mob to break the law, you can't charge him with anything. It's illegal for you to charge him with the crime you just witnessed. And that goes for all royal family members. If your last name's Windsor and you live in the United Kingdom, no one is allowed to press charges against that family for anything, ever. Oh, you can embarrass them in the Star, their little version of the Inquirer, but that's all you're going to be able to do. A very good friend of mine, and I'll just say that. I won't identify this gentleman. A very good friend of mine. He's a very astute person who lives in the UK, who is at an echelon of respect within the community of the world that he has briefed Rothschilds. Okay? This isn't a trite human being. He once told me a story that one of his best friends that he went to college with became a reporter for the BBC. And this is back in the 60s and 70s when we still had something called journalism. and the difference now is that we have reporters. All we have are people that read, you know, teleprompters that come from the AP Reuters, and then we say that's news. Journalists went out and actually stood where they said things were happening and tried to verify that it did happen or was happening or it wasn't happening, right? He said that he, and it's probably best I don't even talk about the specifics, but I've forgotten the specifics, but he had had a, something on the royal family. Something not horribly damning, but it was definitely going to be an embarrassing situation. I'm not even sure it was a criminalistic thing. But he said that he was coming in and out of the BBC, which is a government-sponsored... You know, what's funny about England is they think they're free and their freedom of speech, but their number one news organization is a government organization. Right? The British Broadcasting... Whatever the hell the C stands for. Channel, whatever. It's all government... crafted, right? They're censored by the government. It'd be like CNN and Fox in the United States inside the Pentagon, and the editors have you know, military designation on their shoulders. That's what the BBC is, just so you know, in case you're in America. He was coming in and out of work, and he said two guys came up to him, unmarked. He said they're fairly physically formidable, but very intelligent people, too. And it's really funny. When I went to London a couple times, I remember a bum came up to me, and the guy was wearing pretty much a three-piece suit, asking me for money. He had this amazing, you know, command of the English language and looked fairly trim and healthy, and he's asking me for a couple bucks. And I just said, I'm sorry, I didn't have any money on me. And I said, you know, we're in my country, you'd be an executive. I said, just move to America, man. You'll be fine. And he laughed. And when we went on about our way, but he said these two guys grabbed him as he was walking out the building and suggested that he come with them. And they had procured a little meeting room at the subfloors of the, not subfloors, excuse me, on the first floor of the BBC. Pulled him in there. Essentially said, we know you have this story brewing about the royal family, and we would just like to kindly ask that you no longer pursue that story. And he said that they told him in the most clever way and polite way, like it had been a well-rehearsed script, that if he didn't stop pursuing this, if he continued pursuing this, I hate double negatives, they get all mixed up. But if he continued pursuing this, he was going to be accidented, basically, you know. But he said they were so polite. He goes, it really didn't hurt. He goes, I worked a really long time on this story. And he goes, just the way they approached it with me seemed so positive and uplifting that I let go of the story. One, he didn't want to die. And two, he just said, it just seemed like they made it okay. I think that's interesting. I can't remember what the story's about. I don't even know if it matters. I think stories to simply embarrass someone are sort of stupid, unless they really call out something we need to be concerned about, right? So again, I don't know what it was, but there's a little insight to sort of the control apparatus that this power, this greed power, can facilitate for an individual, right? Now, let's go a little bit deeper into the psychosis, or the psyche, I should say, of someone who has immense power. There's an old movie called Dreamscape, which, for those of you who like a good sort of science, sci-fi, I guess, world, I think it was, is it Dennis Quaid? Randy Quaid's brother? I think he's the main character in it, if I remember right. But anyway, it's about I think David Lowery wrote it, who I have connections with. But it's about these guys that can actually go into your dreams and mess with you while you're asleep. They have the ability to sleep next to you and then penetrate your dreams, like a psychic that can penetrate your dreams. And it's all fun and games for a little while until they figure out that the President of the United States, who is a fictional character at the time, old guy, is starting to have major fears of a nuclear war. And he's going to disarm. I believe the storyline is he's going to disarm the United States in order to make sure that the apocalypse that he keeps dreaming about never occurs. And so the dude from the movie Warriors, who was the, I forget the hell the name of the gang that actually shot Cyrus, but the guy with the little, you know, Miller Lite bottles, and he's banging on his thing, he's saying, Warriors, that dude is the main bad guy in Dreamscape, because it was just within a couple, it was probably within 3 years of Warriors being made, and he plays this nice bad guy. And he's the assassin from the intelligence side that has the same exact abilities, but he's going to go in and kill the president. And so our main hero's going in, and he's going to kill the agent that's going in. And so the president's stuck in this dream with two agents in his dream, and they're trying to kill him. And he's having this horrible nightmare of being on a train that's also burned out, like Fallout 4, where he's seeing the apocalyptic world outside. And he's talking to our good guy, and he's like, you see, I did all this. I did this. And I can't let this happen. As soon as I wake up, I'm going to get rid of all the nuclear bombs or whatever. And take the inverse of that, where you have someone who's of immense power, and they're psychotic. They have a mental problem. Now, you might assume that, well, there's more than one person at the top of the pyramid, of the capstone of the pyramid, and they would self-regulate. If someone shows that they have crazy, then they'd just be wiped out at the top or decommissioned, right? And I think that it would be silly to think that they would actually have it so well controlled that even if you knew someone was crazy, could you actually stop them? And what's interesting is we see this within the royal families of, say, the Saudis. And, you know, I think we've been fortunate that, I guess, I don't know everything that they do at that level, but I think we've been fortunate that the Saudis have had leaders that have been fairly chill, fairly cool. You know, yeah, they repress their people, and I'm not trying to say they're great people, but I'm just saying they haven't gone nutso yet, right? They haven't slung a nuclear weapon at another state, if those exist, right? There was an interesting documentary. You might hear me say that, and you're going, what the hell are you talking about? Do they exist? I worked on a screenplay treatment for, God, probably 8 months with a friend of mine. It was all about nuclear weapons, and I've had a fairly decent understanding and historical understanding of nuclear weapons because I was a huge physicist major in school. And so, you know, I grew up with all the traditional thoughts about nuclear weapons, that they existed. That obviously, there was testing from, you know, probably, what, 40, 45 up to, or say 44 up to 73. And those are above-ground Bikini Island explosions that we kept seeing, right? And we know Nagasaki and Hiroshima happened, right? But there was this interesting conspiracy that that nuclear weapons potentially were never really made of nuclear materials, that they're somehow able to create this gigantic explosion through more conventional means. Now, once you actually study Hiroshima, you start to see the horrible effects of radiation poisoning. And so once you do that research, you realize that something very nuclear took place, right? It wasn't just a bunch of TNT. You can't hold a megaton of TNT inside of a plane and fly it anywhere, right? But it might be that those exist, but we actually haven't created a military out of them because we haven't seen an ICBM fly up out of the water. If a Trident submarine cross the ocean and then hit Bikini Island from above, right? We've always had planes fly over and drop whatever tests were happening out of planes, right? So there was a theory that basically nuclear weapons do exist, but the world powers came together and said, well, we don't really want these things out there, do we, guys? Right? So we're going to conduct a bunch of tests to get the society in check because they really are terrified of these things. So every time we set up a test, it's really going to be a bunch of TNT that's going to create the same pop. We will continue to test the, you know, maybe some of the fat boy drops, the hydrogen bomb, the neutron bomb, that kind of stuff. But those will be very strategic tests, and we just mothball the tech, right? I think all this is a pretty big stretch, right? Most of us realize that nuclear power plants actually metabolize up some of the base components for plutonium. You know, that's why they don't want Iran or Africa to have a single nuclear power plant, because, you know, Africa's packed with uranium for one thing, But, you know, it's also fairly free energy, and free energy or relatively cheap energy causes population explosions, right? Because it facilitates growth. Anyway, but imagine someone at the top of this pyramid who has this huge greed thing going on. This, I can tell you what to do and you can't tell me no. And I have this this agenda of how to run the world on top of that. Now, we're obviously hoping that there's a lot of cross-referencing people that actually sit at a round table up there at the top and keep everybody in check. And once one guy starts twitching every day because he's drinking too much alcohol or he's got, gonorrhea eating up his brain or something, that the guy's taken out of commission. You know, Joe's crazy over there. Yeah, I know. Okay, you're going to stab him in the head? Nah, I'll have Joe do it. You know, all these kind of things that they get rid of the person at the top that's crazy. And hell, maybe there's some sort of educational system to even get to the table. Maybe there's a daily regimen of, are you crazy? Take this test every other day or something. You know, who knows? Who knows what they do to regulate the very top of the pyramid? And again, it's not one committee that runs the entire planet, I don't think. I think there's a lot of different committees in different regions, and they barter and they negotiate at the top, at best, right? And for those of you who struggle with the notion of a single body running the planet, what you have to understand is that agendas are hatched in every first world country on the same week, all the time, right? Climate change, which, by the way, is based on non-existent science, right? Again, there's barely any CO2 in the greenhouse gas layer. There's more oxygen on the surface of the sun than CO2 in the greenhouse gas layer. But we're all afraid of this thing. It's really about population control. Tax people for using energy. Energy consumption becomes too expensive to actually have freely. And therefore, everyone who's multiplying as a result of free energy will not be able to multiply. It's really just that simple, right? It's to reduce world population slowly. GMOs are the other way. Eat GMOs, well, you're eating a terminated gene sequence that keeps the seeds from procreating. Your body will then go infertile, and you won't be able to have babies a couple generations down. Everyone will be sterile. I'm going to tell you right now, if this video were to ever survive, I can tell you 75 to 100 years from now, humanity will not be able to spawn, and that'll be the big cover story on Time Magazine. Perhaps GMOs were more dangerous than we ever previously thought. Oh, yeah, you think you're going to replace 97% of the food supply with less than 20 years of clinical study? And everyone says, well, all the reports say that GMOs are just as good as anything else. Oh, yeah. Who bought those studies? Monsanto, right? It's a big cabal. It's a big cabal against population increasing. It doesn't matter how many people are really on the planet Earth. They don't want any more. It's hard to control at the top. But greed. So how do we boil all this back down to humanity and us, right? Yeah, I can tell you everything. Even if I had the whole schematic of how the elite work at the top, what good does that do you? It makes you almost more frustrated to go to sleep at night because they have all this crazy quarantining power up there. I'm pretty sure that the ruling class wrote the line in the Bible, which says, the meek shall inherit the earth. Turn the other cheek, right? Don't fight for anything. Take it 100% on the chin. Be abused. Don't want for anything. Money's bad. I'm pretty sure they wrote those passages, right? Let's say that you wanted to amass tremendous wealth so that you could combat the ruling class without them knowing it, right? Maybe even as fast as you acquire the money, you liquidate it into the assets that will allow you to combat them. You make really nice documentaries. You do whatever the hell your technique is, right? You're sort of untraceable because you don't seem to keep your money and they think you're some idiot that's spending it all on frivolous stuff, right? In that realm, going after a bunch of money actually would have very little effect on your soul and it would be your purpose in life. It wouldn't be a bad thing. Per me, right? It's just when we get to that point where we take the 11th thing, and from my analogy at the beginning of this video, you only need 10 and you take 11. Once you cross that line, you got to check yourself a little bit. And hey, every once in a while, we're going to do that. Maybe it's just that we're lazy and we're like, oh, I don't have to make another trip. If I took 20, I don't have to come back next week to get my other five, right? My other 5 days worth of food. As long as you're not hurting anybody else and there's plenty to go around, Maybe you're not being greedy. Maybe you're just being efficient. It's just that when you don't need it and you do it, you might have crossed that line a little bit. It's probably a battle we're all going to fight for the rest of our lives, honestly, right? I used to go to this Indian restaurant in Mountain View, California, which is up in the Bay Area. And you sit down at this restaurant. It's called Sue's Kitchen. And right next to the wall, whatever wall, wherever it was, where they usually have a little promo of what their specials are today or what beers they have on tap or whatever, it said something to the effect of, please don't order more food than you need because the world, you know, is struggling to feed everybody, sort of thing. And it was more beautiful than that, but I thought that was a fantastic little passage. And they even said, look, don't order water if you're not going to drink it. And they're not trying to pad their wallets. But the people who ran this restaurant obviously took, you know, had full knowledge of India. And they saw little kids digging in the trash just to make ends meet, just to fill their belly, you know. Now, a lot of times people try to make us go below our strategic resources or live right at the precipice of our strategic resources, having no pleasure zone above that, because they're saying other people in other countries don't have what they need. Well, they're going to have to rise up where they are the best they can. And, you know, this idea that we can run around policing the universe to have as much as we have, it just doesn't work. Because if you were to step in, reset the country, put a bunch of people at the top to then facilitate the impoverished to have what you have, if the impoverished aren't heavily educated to be of your perspective of life, they're going to go back to being impoverished, back to being ruled by others, you know? That's why this whole thing with, was it Bernie Sanders, this guy running for president, who's has every single entitled hipster thinking he's the greatest thing on planet Earth. What's that guy going to do? He's actually the end of America if he ever gets in, because he's going to say taxes are the only way that we can live, because he's a total socialist. So he's thinking, we'll just tax all these rich people, all these people that keep your world going in a circle, because not all of them are bad, right? I think the majority of the world is actually made of good people because of how wealthy they are. And once you tax them out of their incentive, okay, you're doing the bidding of the major corporations. Right, Barry Sanders will never be allowed to tax a corporation any more than they already taxed. Barry Sanders, if he ever became president, which I think is a joke at this point, but if he ever did become president, he would still have to give the huge concessions, tax breaks, look the other way, import tariffs to all of his financiers of his campaign, and they're in power no matter if you make it through your own wallet or not, right? He'll never be able to do anything but tax the threatening layer of humanity that is approaching the top of the pyramid. You know, the independent guy who has a lot of wealth starts going towards the top of the pyramid. What happens? Well, there's a formula here in the world, which is they're made a celebrity, and then they're knocked down. They get allured into celebrityness, right? Into celebrityhood, celebrity worship, and they kind of like it, man. They walk into a crowd and it's like, my God, everyone loves me. This is fantastic. And as soon as you suck that tit, you take that Faustus pill, where you sign the deal with the devil, where your emotional feedback of yourself is artificially blown up by a paparazzi or by a magazine cover or by people that you consider to be your peers. They got you. You know, that's why all these celebrities and music and movies, they immediately become dependent on the system. And then they are always ceremoniously taken down. You know, I've got a show that I've completely filmed. It's about the movie Rollerball. It's a deep thoughts about the movie Rollerball. I did a cigar review on my other channel, which is actually perfect, but no one's going to watch it because I'm reviewing a cigar in between this the discussion. But there's this algorithm of futility that the greedy use against humanity. And it goes something like this, you know, we don't get to observe them. You know, we think we understand the Rothschilds are at the top. We have a few monarch families we believe are at the top. We definitely know about sort of the peasant rich people like the Koch brothers and that sort of thing. But the real power is completely invisible to us, right? They don't get mentioned on the internet. Their name comes up and then the search goes to nothing, you know? Or maybe like to some ancillary historical document of their family's existence, but nothing modern. Nothing where you can pin down where they live or what they own or anything like that, right? Remember, the member banks of the private for-profit Federal Reserve Bank, which is printed at the top of every single United States dollar, they're unknown to the world. We don't know who they are. A little bit weird, right? But the short and dirty of Rollerball is that it's a movie about a game that people play that's supposed to demonstrate the futility of individualism, right? And that's what the paparazzi's there to do. Your TMZs are allowed to exist. And if TMZ went out of business, something else would fill its slot in 2 seconds as a mandate from the ruling class down to the peasant. So that if someone rises up, you know, what is it? Mark Cuban was going to finance the full blowout of the movie Loose Change to expose the fact that 9/11 was an inside job, something it does perfectly in its first version of the film. But Charlie Sheen was going to narrate it. Mark Cuban was going to pay for it. The second that that news went out, those two guys were going to collaborate with the three kids that made the film, or really the two kids that made the film. Mark Cuban had a major conspiracy of insider trading on his back. And Charlie Sheen had all kinds of problems, right? They dragged his marriage into the game and all of his substance abuse and all that stuff. Both those guys went down like a bag of hammers, man, because they were starting to play with the game that is way outside of their league in the minds of those who run the world. And it's always going to be like that if we don't start communicating that to each other. Because what if it happened where if we all said, okay, as citizens of those that are awake, right, the non-sheep of the world, which if you're watching me at this late stage in the video, that is who you are. And we said, okay, we got another smoking gun that we're going to reveal, something new that's yet to occur. But it occurs, and we see it. And we find a billionaire like Cuban, and we find some people that are 100 millionaires like Charlie Sheen, both well-respected individuals, and maybe there's a female in there somewhere. And we say, okay, we videotape it initially without going out and making the absolutely obvious mistake of just trying to march out and do this. We videotape to the community, to the world, really. All right, we sit them down, we interview them, and we say, all right, you're willing to finance this, right? Person says, yes. And you're willing to narrate it, right? Yes. Okay, so we know how this is going to go, right? They say, yes. And we say, you're going to be attacked, and you're going to be attacked. All right, so let's hear where you think they're going to attack you. And this guy goes, well, I've done this and this and this. They're probably going to accuse me of that, which I haven't done. This person's like, well, you know, I've had my run-in with heroin, so I'm going to be attacked for this. All right, and we just exhaust the whole algorithm before they do it. And then they go out and they do what they do. Remember, Charlie Sheen wrote Obama a letter the second he got in office, 11-page letter, I think, where he said, I think you need to open up the investigation for 9/11 because there's a lot of questions. That's immediately when I think he went on Jimmy Kimmel and they tried to roast him. And Jimmy literally fell for it. Jimmy was like, I heard you're crazy. And ha, ha, ha. And oh, I heard you have divorce problems. So Jimmy was saying, you want to keep your show. You need to roast this guy. Just insert a reasonable doubt in the credibility of Charlie Sheen because he has a bad marital problem. You know, and because we have full surveillance on this guy, well, we know he's buying drugs. We know he's, seven-ounce rocks or whatever the hell he said, you know. But we say it ahead of time. So when the world says, oh, well, you see, that billionaire's got all those problems and this guy over here's got all these other issues, well, then we roll the tape that we recorded beforehand. And we say, look, this is what we knew was going to take place because this is how they play their game. So we roll the pre-interview. And then for each topic that they mention that they think they're going to get roasted for, as they get roasted on CNN, Fox, late night shows, we run the roast, and then we run their prediction of the roast, prediction of the roast, or vice versa. And we simply level the playing ground so that the world understands that this is the way the system works. You know? How many greats always go down the tubes? You know, people who are extremely wealthy go down the tubes. Was it MC Hammer made like $30 million in a couple of years with his, you can't touch this song? And he surrounded himself with people that bled him dry. And he said, you know, I didn't even know where some of these guys came from. I don't even know who they were. Some of them were my friends and they did it to me, but a bunch of them were embezzling cash from me and stealing all my money. Now the guy is damn near penniless. You think that was a mistake? Absolutely not. How could a white aristocratic guy allow ghetto black kids to believe that if they actually invested in talent, they could come out of the ghetto and then go back into the ghetto, maybe reinvest or pull everyone out of the ghetto or redo the ghetto or whatever? You can't have the thought that that's going to work. You have to believe as a repressed black kid that there is no hope for you. You have to believe that if the aristocrats are going to program your mind, let alone all the white guys that bring you the kilos of drugs that you divide up and sell on your streets, and then you fight over each other and kill each other because someone was selling crack on your corner, right? It's this incestual loop. And greed fuels it all. So now you guys feel me. And there's a lot more to greed than I can get to in one sitting. But this is the sort of the substrate of greed. You know, just remember, it's all from a perspective of those who develop the disease. The disease is a common thread. How it's applied to someone's life is relative to their life experiences. And so one form of greed is different, but it's all built out of insecurities. Insecurities that someone's going to tell you what to do. Insecurities that you haven't become something in the world. And so it's a patch on that true, deep-rooted sense of being. The greed is going to, almost like the Faustus deal with the devil, greed is a false promise that it's actually going to fix anything in your life. Right? It never does. It absolutely, positively never does. Well, you might have a fleeting moment where you have more than someone else and it mattered. But in the end, at your deathbed, greed won't make the moment any sweeter. You know, go read the last writings of Steve Jobs. It's this little one-page essay he wrote about how the one thing in life that he really shortchanged, which is the most important thing in life, is love. I know that sounds hippie-ish. Love doesn't necessarily put food on the table. But he said, look, I have become the cliche that I always talked about, which is I'm the richest guy in the graveyard. How sad is that? You know, the relationship he should have had with his child, with his wife, it didn't happen properly. And he realized that at the end, and I'm sure he made amends with all those people. But it's a little too late, right? Let's not be like that. Let's learn from these masters who've had it all. You know, and let's build up a self-identity. And I think most of you personally listening to this, you've already got your finger on the pulse of what reality really is about. But as we discuss things with other people, or we feel the temptations to go towards a greed algorithm, let's pull back and check ourselves. And don't punish yourself if you happen to catch yourself in the middle of greed, feeling yourself lust for greed. Just know you have the equipment now. You probably did before I said anything, but use the equipment you have to just battle it another day. We all have temptations of all different kinds, and we're human, we're flawed, and the more you open your mind to the universe, the more you will take in chaotic thoughts that really don't mesh with who you really are, but you're having the thoughts anyway because you're just observing what could be in your life, what maybe was in your life. And it's like turning on the television and you see a horrific thing. That horrific thing doesn't become your life. You just saw something that now you can't unsee. And at best, just try to learn from it, right? I know you feel me. I'm going to shut up here. MKUltraRadio.com. So we're going to get a ton of these things. I got quite a few in the queue here. So as of this recording, I've got three that are scheduled to release here. So this will be the fourth one I'm going to put in the queue this evening. I wish you well. Let's focus on our strategic resources. Let's focus on the internal of our souls. Let's raise our kids to make sure that no one else owns their opinion of themselves but them. You know, don't let your daughters think that a boy gets to determine whether or not they're pretty. And don't let your sons think that a woman's going to have the drop on whether or not they're actually a man or not. Make sure they own that and make sure that we own it for ourselves. Anyway, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next episode. Over now.
Now, if the greenbacks don't stack large on my side of the yard, I ain't fucking with it. This cake has got to be all icing, baby.
Now I know I'm taking the biggest piece, but goddamn, I'm the biggest fish with the biggest mouth, bitch. You wanna be rich, right?
Hell yeah.
Well, stick with me. Do as I does, and be as I be. We be stacking chips, packing clips.